This is the question I want us to struggle with tonight under the subject, Christ, the Lord of Creation. For you see, at every moment of every day, you and I are standing on one side of that bar, looking out on the whole created order. If you look carefully, there are mud and stars and their equivalent in every situation. This world in which we find ourselves is not one thing, but it is many things. It is a many-splendored kind of reality. And why is it that as we look at all of this myriad existence about us, two people look through the self-same bars, one sees mud and the other stars? I suppose the beginning of an answer has to come in underlining the fact that the creatures that are on one side of those bars are radically different than that which is on the other side of the bars. What I'm suggesting is that our humankind have been given powers that mud and stars do not possess. There is something that I can do to the objects of creation that the objects of creation cannot do back to me. Now, what is that? I, as a human being, have been given the gift of interpretation. I am personal. That is, I have the ability to know, to discern, to stand over against. And not only do I have all of this power simply to observe, I have the power to decide what kind of value I'm going to give to all of those objects that are beyond me. I think this is the meaning of that old part of the ancient story in Genesis, where the humankind were given the privilege of naming the animals. God creates the whole world, places man and woman down in the midst of it, and then shows them all the animal kingdom and says, "You go and name these various creatures." Now, in the ancient world, naming was a very profound process. It started with the ability to discern. That is, to begin to name was to begin to know, to examine, to inquire. And yet, even after the creature had gathered all of the information about an animal, that did not end the naming process. Then he or she was given the power to assess the value of that creature. That is, to decide what kind of significance that was going to have for the living out of his or her own life. The naming process began by saying, what is something made of? That's the analytic task. Then asking the question, what do I make of it? That's taking all this information and putting it together in some form. And then finally saying, what am I going to let this make of me? That is, what kind of significance am I going to give to this particular reality that is over against myself? How am I going to name this, value this? What role am I going to allow this to have in my life? Which, see, when we were given the gift of interpretation, we humans were therefore given a power in the drama of creation. Now, the mud and the stars do not have this power, but by being given the gift of naming something, you and I can create in our own image. That is, we can take these perceptions that we have and out of which we use to name the rest of the other orders, and therefore we can participate in the meaning that these things are going to have. Therefore, the beginning of why the creature on one side of the bar is able to do something that the creatures on the other side of the bar are not able to do is that we as humankind are homo interpretus. That is, we have the power to discern, to evaluate, and to name the various realities that are about us. And this gives us tremendous power. This makes us a creator and a meaningful participant in the whole drama of creation. I think it's significant that we recognize that having this power to name and assess and to give value to the things that are beyond us is of crucial importance. Yea, that is the way that we begin to exercise our personhood in the midst of the drama of creation. I remember the first time that I began to realize that I, as a human being, had been gifted with the power of interpretation. I was all of 6 years old. I had a very gifted teacher in a primary Sunday school class in Bob Norman's church, Belmont Heights. This was a lady that knew how to use all of our senses. She wasn't confined to just the conceptual way of teaching. And I remember on the Sunday before Thanksgiving, when I was 6 years old, we came into the Sunday school classroom, and there on the table was a container half filled with a red-looking substance. And as the class began, she allowed us to interact with that with all of our senses. She let us smell it. She let us taste it. She let us pick it up to see how heavy it was. She got us all involved in every kind of interaction with that object. And then at a point she said, tell me, is the container half empty or half full? There was a little girl in our class who reminds me of Lucy in the comic strip of Peanuts. Her mouth was always about that wide open. She was usually being negative in the things that she said. And this Lucy-type character immediately blurted out, it's half empty, it's half empty. There was another little boy in the class who was more thoughtful and reflective. He was the prototype of a philosopher, and he answered back, no, it's not, it's half full. And so the debate began to go back and forth, and some of the rest of us joined in. And at the appropriate moment, I remember that our teacher said, you know, the truth is that both of you are correct from a factual standpoint. There is a way of looking at this and say it is half empty. There's another way of looking at it and saying it's half full. Both of you are technically correct, but there is a tremendous difference in how you choose to relate to this particular condition. That is, if you choose to focus in on what is not there, if you emphasize the half emptiness, then as a rule, you're going to be dissatisfied, displeased, you're going to be wishing that there had been more, and you're going to leave the experience with a sense of negativeness in your mouth. On the other hand, if you choose to focus in on the half fullness, on what is there, then you're going to have a sense of gratitude and a sense of excitement for what you have been given. She says both of these are correct technically, but it makes all the difference in the world in how you choose to relate to this less than perfect situation. Well, that was the beginning of my becoming aware that I had been given a special kind of creative power. I began to sense as a six-year-old boy that while I could not determine what life would do to me, I could determine what kind of responses I would begin to make. I had been given the power to name. I had been given the power to respond to the various facets of existence, and in my interpreting of which I would maximize, the half-emptiness or the half-fullness, I was given a certain power on what that particular condition was going to mean to me. Well, as I had grown from that beginning awareness of myself as homo interpretus, I have recognized that there is more involved here than simply the choice of perception. Here is the beginning of two whole ways of coping with reality. Here is the secret of how we either approach the less than perfect that we're always encountered with, the mud and the stars or their equivalent that are always there, and we either have a tendency to focus in on the negative and therefore have energy taken out of us, or we have the tendency to focus in on what is positive, on that which is there, and thus find that energy and hope is being put into us. And it can make all the difference in the world, not just in the way you perceive something, but in the kind of power that you come to possess for the coping with the actualities of life. About 30 years after I had this experience with the half-full, half-empty container in a Sunday school classroom, I went as a parish minister one day to visit the hospital. I went up to the 8th floor, went into a room where a member of my church was a patient. This lady was in her mid-80s. She had all kinds of physical problems. She was in what Paul Tillich would call a boundary situation. That is, very few options, lots of things wrong, not much going for her, lots of things going against her. And I had hardly gotten good in the room that she began to catalog all of her complaints against the real tough situation in which she found herself. She resented having been brought to the hospital, much preferred staying at home. She said that it drove her distracted, all these people that walk in and out all the times of the day and night. She says they walk in here at night to find out if you're asleep. They won't give you any kind of rest whatsoever. Then she complained about the sheets on the bed. She said they are so rough, they're just like sandpaper. And then she said the food is terrible, and after all, I don't have many teeth left, and it's very difficult for me to eat and to chew. I find the whole experience to be utterly debilitating. There was nothing that I could do about any of those qualities. She was accurate in her assessment. I tried my best to give her some consolation. I offered prayer with her. I have no idea what I did for her, but I know full well what she did for me. She depressed the heck out of me. Robert Browning had not visited that room before he wrote, "The best is yet to be, the last is life for which the first is made," because that woman and all of her problems really served to drag me down. Though she was accurate in describing, the realities that she was up against. Under that kind of a depressed, heavy feeling, I went down two stories, went into another room, and lo and behold, there was yet another member of my church, also in her mid-80s, a lady who had much the same kind of situation on her hands. But with the memory fresh in my mind of the lady two floors up, I recall beginning to brace myself for another onslaught of complaining. In fact, I even had the checklist ready. I walked in and I said, "I know you're sorry to have to leave home and come to the hospital." But lo and behold, this old lady said, "You know, the truth is, I love my home, but I have some physical problems now that my folks can't take care of. The word hospital comes from the same root as the word hospitality. I'm really glad there are institutions like this that people in my condition can come to." And I said, "Well, I'll say," under my breath. But I still wasn't convinced. I said, "I guess you really hate all this commotion, people coming in all hours of the days and night." And she said, "Well, you know, the truth is that I live with my family, and they're great to me, but all of them have things to do, and they're busy. And there are times that I really get lonely in my room." And she said, "I have really enjoyed the opportunity here to meet all kinds of new and different people." She said, "Every time I hear the door open, I say, I wonder what new kind of surprise is going to come. I've met some of the cutest nurses, some of the most handsome interns. I have loved these people coming in and out of my hospital room." And I said to myself, "Well, I'll say," but I still didn't give up. I said, "I'm sure you find the hospital bed tough to cope with. I understand that the sheets are just like sandpaper. They're so rough." And she brightened up and said, "You know what?" She said, "They change the sheets here every day. We only change them at home once a month." Once a month? You talk about luxury. This is really it. I still couldn't believe it, and I made one more run by her, and I said, "I'm sure that the cooking here in the hospital is not what you enjoy at home." And that lady said, "I live with my daughter-in-law, and she is a great cook, but you know, she tends to cook the same things the same way, and to be honest, I get a little bored. It really has been nice to come and have the variety of another cook." And she says, "To be honest with you, I only have two teeth left, and it really is hard for me to eat. But thank the Lord, they hit." When that lady made that last statement about the two teeth, "thank the Lord, they hit," I felt like stepping back and giving her a snappy salute. It reminded me that all the heroism of life is not confined to the battlefield. Here was an aged lady up against incredibly difficult circumstances, and yet, in contrast to the lady upstairs, somehow she had learned how to focus in on the half full rather than the half empty. She had found a way of maximizing what she had going for her rather than what she had going against her. She had learned to take a situation much like a sailor takes the wind and learned how to incorporate that into her ongoingness, whereas the lady upstairs, still talking factually about her situation, had learned to take that which was half empty, the mud in her situation that was unmistakably there. And I saw in the way those two women were coping with identical circumstances, this enormous power that we have as homo interpretus, this power that has been given to us not only to discern conditions, but to name them and to decide what kind of role that they're going to have in our lives. And I would suggest to you that this enormous power that we possess in relation to the creation, our power to give a name and assess the significance that something will happen, that this is tremendously important. In fact, there are even clinical names that can be given to the two conditions that these older women in the hospital embody. The lady that I talked about in the latter category is what William James would call healthy-minded. She is a person who had learned how to make the most of what was given. She was not free to determine what happened to her. She was free to give a positive assessment as best she could to those less than perfect situations. The woman that I spoke about first that was up on the top floor, the name of her condition is neurotic. Now that word, simply technically put, is a chronic dissatisfaction with the situation in which you find yourself. Dr. Karen Horney is recognized as one of the great worldwide authorities on neurotic behavior, and she gives a very easily understood rule of thumb definition and distinction. She says a psychotic person is the person who says 2 + 2 = 5. That is, they are really out of touch with reality. They're really coming off the wall, as my son has a way of saying about certain people. They are simply out of touch. They don't know where reality is. A neurotic is a person who says 2 + 2 = 4, but I don't like it. That is, they are in touch with reality, but the part they are in touch with, the part they have chosen to maximize, is the negative, the half-empty side. The mud is over against the star. And the neurotic person is the person who has learned to focus on the negative, and therefore is the person who is chronically dissatisfied wherever they find themselves, no matter what the condition. Martin Marty says that Winston Churchill, in the midst of his long political career, used to like to tell the story about the British family that went out on a holiday. They were having a picnic right by a lake, and their little 5-year-old son inadvertently fell into the deep water. Nobody in the family knew how to swim. Everybody was screaming, rushing around on the bank. And a man who happened to be passing by sensed the situation, the emergency of it, and so at great risk to his own personal safety, dived into the water fully clothed, barely got to the child just before he went under for the third time, managed to rescue him, get him out of the water, presented him back to his mother, healthy and intact. And do you know what the mother chose to say to this response, to this person who had responded to their situation? Instead of thanking the stranger for his heroic injection of himself, do you know what she said peevishly? "Where is Johnny's cap?" You see, in all of this process, the child's hat had gotten lost, and out of all the things that that woman had to respond to, she chose to focus in on the loss of a hat rather than the saving of a boy. If you want to know what neurotic behavior is, it's the person in that situation who chooses to ask, "Where's Johnny's cap?" rather than, "Thanks be to God for somebody who has come and rescued the life of my child." These then are clinically definable conditions: healthy-mindedness, focusing in on the half-fullness, as over against neurotic behavior, focusing in on the half-empty. You know, the people that gave Jesus the greatest problem, those that caused him the most discomfort, were those neurotic types in whose presence he constantly found himself living. In fact, on one occasion, for the 100th time, somebody like this woman, who couldn't find anything good, criticized Jesus for something that he had done or something that he said. And I think in a kind of weary frustration, Jesus turned to the other people that were there. He said, "Do you know what folk like this remind me of? They remind me of children that got up on the wrong side of the bed. And when you hear them out in the marketplace trying to play, one group of children says, 'I'll tell you what, let's play wedding. Let's go get some bright colored clothes and let's get out our pipes and let's celebrate a wedding.' And the other children say, 'We don't want to play wedding. We don't feel like that. We don't want to have anything to do with that kind of celebration.' And so the other people, trying to be accommodating, say, 'Well, if you're feeling bad, let's go to the other end of the extreme. Let's play funeral. Let's go get some black clothes and walk around with long faces and let's live into how you're feeling.' And they say, 'No, we don't want to play funeral either.'" Now Jesus says there's some people that choose to be dissatisfied no matter what is proposed. And then he says that's exactly the way these people have reacted. John the Baptist came, not eating like other people ate, not drinking anything, dressing like someone who was an utter ascetic, and these neurotic people said, "There's something wrong with him. He's got a demon." Here I come at the opposite end of the spectrum. I share with people on the same terms that they live their lives, and what do they say? The same people look at me and say, "Why, he's nothing but a glutton and a wine bibber. Can you expect to take that buffoon seriously as a religious leader by living exactly like the rest of folk do?" In other words, Jesus encountered neurotic behavior, people who had chosen to be dissatisfied. And therefore, the first thing that we need to underline is that we humans have been given an enormous power, the power of discernment, the power of interpretation. We have been given the gift of naming the various realities of our lives. Two persons looked through the self-same bars. One saw mud, the other stars. Now the question is, we who have this power in relation to creation, why is it that we tend to be so neurotic? Why is it that we are prone to focus on the half empty rather than the half full, to ask peevishly, where is Johnny's cap? But once again, Dr. Karen Horney has suggested the neurotic behavior many times goes back to what she calls a very basic condition, a thing that she describes as basic anxiety. She says that this is born early in the human experience, sometime after the infant has come out of the mother's womb, where all was provided and all was protected. Birth is a traumatic experience of separation, for the little infant finds himself or herself in a new context. And that little infant is bound to begin to ask, what kind of world is this into which I have come? Will I be cared for here in the same way that I was cared for in my mother's womb? Is this a context that I can trust? And the little infant is also asking, is it good that I be here? Am I welcomed here as someone who is esteemed? Or am I an intruder into this scene? Are the people that I find about me glad that I am here and a part of this reality? Or do they look on me with scorn and wish that I was not here? Now, this is the process that is the beginning of every individual's life. And Dr. Horney says that early in this process, the neurotic person comes to negative conclusions about themselves and their place in the universe. They answer those beginning primal inquiries with negative feelings about themselves and about the context. And therefore, they begin to image themselves as persons who are not suitable for this context. They begin to see the world about them as not the way it ought to be. And the kind of chronic dissatisfaction that I encountered in a hospital room, that man encountered when he had saved a mother's boy's life, that kind of chronic discontent with the way things are, Dr. Horney traces back to basic discontent with the first thing that has ever happened to a person, namely their own creation, the way they come into history from the hand of God, what they are, when they are, where they are. And when you begin to feel negative about self at this primal beginning point, it's just like adding up a column of figures and you make a mistake between the first and second numbers. No matter how many other numbers you add to the column, you're going to come out with a mistaken answer. And Dr. Horney says that most people make a mistake way back there in the beginning. They image themselves as not something good coming from the hand of God. And therefore, creation begins to look very negative to them, because their first touch with creation, that is, the first thing that God ever did in making them, is given a negative name and image, and all kinds of poison begins to flow from that. If anybody in our culture today understands basic anxiety, I think it's Charles Schulz, the creator of the comic strip Peanuts. There is, in that classic figure of Charlie Brown, all of the living out of the very kinds of realities that I'm talking about. Several years ago, I clipped out, because I thought it was so poignant, one particular episode where Charlie was sitting on a fence looking so lonely, talking to his friend Linus about his chronic insecurity. He said, "You know, I have been insecure from the very beginning. Why, the day I was born and stepped on the stage, they took one look at me and said, not right for the part." Now, that is basic anxiety. When you feel like from the moment you have stepped on the stage of history that all the big powers are saying, he is not right for the part, he doesn't have what it takes, he is not what he ought to be as he comes from the hand of the Creator. If that is your beginning image of yourself and your place in the universe, then there is no surprise that beginning with that kind of negative feeling toward your creation, that poison of negativism begins to spread. The TA people have devised a spectrum. You have probably seen it. It goes five positions to the left and five positions to the right. The numbers on the left are negatives. The numbers on the right are positive. And the first negative position is, I'm not okay. And when that becomes the way you feel about yourself, then it follows logically, -2, you're not okay. -3, we're not okay. -4, they're not okay. -5, it's not okay. Do you see how negativism was the first thing that God ever did, creating me, if it becomes the primal image, begins to spread until everything in creation looks negative, everything in creation is responded to with dissatisfaction. The half-emptiness is what we see, and the half-sense of mudness that is all about us dominates our horizon. In fact, I think that it's true to say that the way we begin to image ourselves is absolutely crucial. Someone said to me the other day that Jesus' familiar word, "Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself," is as much a statement of psychological principle as it is ethical imperative. For the truth is, we do love our neighbor as we love ourselves. We do tend to see other people through the same lenses that we see ourselves. If I have come to feel negative about the way I am from the hand of the Creator, it won't be long till I feel negative about the way you have come, the way all of the larger groupings of society have become. That woman who, in the face of a miracle of rescue, could still find something to be dissatisfied with, must have somewhere way back down deep in her own existence come to feel that life as it is created is really not good, and that primal mistake at the beginning of the column of her life was leading to mistaken interpretations all the way down. Unless I read the Bible wrongly, this is the primal problem which all of us have to work with and all of us have to struggle with. Not liking ourselves as we come from the hand of God, I have become convinced, is the essence of original sin. I used to think original sin was arrogance, rebelling against God and His authority, but I read the stories now in a different light and recognize that there is something far more primal than rebellion that is at the bottom of our human fallen situation. Once again, we have the picture of God creating the world, placing the man and woman down in the midst of an ongoing process, and everything is functioning according to God's design, and there's a great sense of freedom and liberation. And then the serpent comes upon the scene. The serpent is that symbol of something that despises that which God takes delight in, something that does not like the way that God is giving the gift of existence. And so he comes up to the humankind and he says, "Does God say that you can't eat anything in all of this place?" And they correct him and say, "Oh no, God says we can eat of everything except that tree in the middle, which is the symbol of our source. It is here to remind us of God. It is not to be consumed. It is to be the occasion of gratitude." And he begins to laugh, a sinister laugh, and says, "I knew that the old fellow would do it. Don't you realize that he's trying to put something over on you, that he's trying to oppress you? Don't you realize that if you eat of that center tree that he has prohibited, that then you will become as God, you'll be exactly like he is, and by becoming something different, you will thereby become something better." Now, if the human creatures had really liked the event of their own creation, if they had really believed that as they came from the hands of God, they really and truly were good, then they could have responded to the serpent by saying, "We don't want to be God. That's not what we were created to be. Our place in the order is to be humankind, and that is something that is totally and completely good. Therefore, we don't want to become something different. We like being what we are." But somehow that shadow of self-despising had gotten mixed into their consciousness. There was something in them that said, if you become different, you will therefore become better. There is something wrong with the way the Creator has made you. If you become other, you will become better. And it was self-despising that opened the door for all the destructive reality of sin that led to a suspicion of the Creator, rebellion against His design, the coming of chaos where there had been order. God took the chaos and built it up into creation. Here came the despiser, turning the created order back into chaos. And the beginning of the whole process, according to ancient Genesis, is that we didn't think the way we were created by God really was something good. Self-despising opened the door for all the other destructive realities. Unless I'm badly mistaken, this is everybody's problem. This is the essence of original sin. This is what we all have to cope with. Let me get very, very personal. How do you really feel about the event of your creation? I'm talking now about your particular body. I'm talking about your mental capacities, your emotional equipment. How do you feel about the parents through whom God sent you into history? How do you feel about the house where you grew up as a child? How do you regard the events of your own creation? This is the first touch you have with the reality called creation. And most of us, going all the way back and deep down, really don't like the way we have come into history. We wish that we had been somebody else with a different body and a different set of capacity. And this despising of the way we have been given the gifts of creation, it's the problem every one of us are caught in. And unless I'm badly mistaken, you can identify with this. I would certainly have to say that out of my own experience. Those of you that have been around me in the past know that I have often said that the earliest images that I have of myself as a person were profoundly negative. I don't know exactly where I got them, but my earliest images of my own personhood was that I was a nothing, a nobody, that as I was, I didn't have the kinds of values that I really needed. I'm not blaming this on my mother, because God knows there were many other factors at work on me. I do know that she used to say constantly to my sister and me, if you're ever going to amount to anything, you're going to have to make something of yourselves. Now, I guess she meant that as a motivational tool. What came through to me emotionally was, John Claypool, as you are, you don't amount to anything. You are a big fat zero. You are a nothing. And if there's ever going to be any value where you are, you're going to have to go somewhere else and import that value. You're going to have to find significance elsewhere and put it into the center of your existence. As you are, you don't amount to anything. If you're ever going to become something, you got to make something of yourself. Okay, that was the way I began to image my first contact with creation, namely myself. And I can remember this affected the way that I daydreamed as a little child. I don't know what you did when you were young, but I used to sit out on the front porch and swing lazily back and forth in the summer. And I can remember again and again doing that and daydreaming about what I wish that I were. And I can remember thinking, oh, I wish that I was tall and thin. I wish that I had straight black hair. I wish that my name was Dick. I wish I lived in a hotel all the time. I wish I lived in New York. Now you say, well, all children do this. We all fantasize about being somebody else, but wait a minute. When you realize that I was then, as I am now, short and squatty, that I then, as I do now, have brown, wavy hair, that the name John had been given to me by a long family tradition, you'll realize that all of these daydreams, wishing I were tall and thin, wishing my name was Dick, wishing my hair were black and straight, these were ways of saying, as I came from the hand of God, I'm not good, I'm not right for the part, as Charlie Brown so aptly puts it. I imaged myself negatively. I didn't like the first thing that God had ever done for me. And that was not just a passing childhood problem. It persisted with me on into adolescence. Dr. Chester Swore told last night that he came to Ridgecrest first 51 years ago. I came here first in 1947. It was a youth week, 3,000 high school students. This was between my junior and senior year in high school. I met a chick from Memphis who I never had met before and frankly never expected to see again. And I began to proceed to give this stranger the biggest line about myself that you can possibly imagine. For starters, I told her that I was an all-city halfback in Nashville and that there were certain sports writers who thought that I was destined for all-state and maybe all-American as my career unfolded. I really was a fast piece of meat. I really was able to do it. I then told her that my father was the president of an insurance company, that we had two cars, both of them Cadillacs, that at that very moment my parents were in Europe where they went every summer, that I had been there several times before, but this summer I had chosen to come to Ridgecrest. Martin Luther says, if you're going to sin, sin boldly. I had not learned the words, but I'd learned the tune by that time. And so I was really giving her this big line. If some of you feminists are sitting out there getting angry, let me say that the things she told me about herself were equally fantastic. And I would suggest to you who are here, having never seen some people before and never expecting to see them again, man, male and female, ask for an ID card. If they do it in the bars, you might as well ask it of the people who are talking to you here about who they are. But in order for you to understand the significance of what I was telling this girl about myself, you need to lay it alongside the actualities. I got to be perfectly honest, I was not all city halfback. At that point in time, I was hoping against hope to make the starting team as the center on a single wing offense. That's the guy that disappears once the ball has been snapped, never to be seen again until the next huddle is called. The only all I was ever was all out of breath at the end of practice. Never was named to any kind of special team. My father was not the president of an insurance company. He was a minor official. We did not have two cars, both of them Cadillacs. We had one, a stripped-down Chevrolet, and what made matters worse, it belonged to the company, and therefore I was not allowed to drive it. My parents have not yet been to Europe. In fact, the closest that they have ever come to it is seeing images of it at that time on Saturday afternoon in the March of Times newsreels in the theater. All of these things that I was telling this girl about myself, laying aside for a moment the issue of personal honesty, represent the kind of self-despising that I say to you is the heart of most of our problems. We don't like who we really are. If we're free, Walter Mitty style, to let go of our fantasies, what we would tell people about ourselves if we don't have to be accountable to reality is something radically different than what is. And am I really very far from your experience? What have you been telling people this week about yourself? How do you feel about your coming into history, your touch with creation, all of these things about you as you come from the hand of God? Unless I am badly mistaken, the truth is tonight that most of us, deep down in our hearts, have an argument with God that goes all the way back to the first thing he ever did, and that was to create us. And because we start with this negative feeling about the first experience of creation, this is why we have so much trouble not being critical of others. This is why we live so much of our life in rage against the way it is, against society, against institutions, against all of the ways that creation touches our life. And out of this deep pit of self-despising that goes all the way back and all the way down to the event of our own creation, we cry with the Apostle Paul, is there anything that can be done for this kind of neurosis? Is there any hope for those who, having made a mistake up there in the first column of figures, is there any hope that healing can come to our kind of sickness? And here's where I get to the last and the good news that I've got to share with you, and that is neurotics of the world. And I put myself in the forefront, neurotics of the world, thanks be to God, there is some hope. And the hope is found in the one who is the title of the sermon tonight, Christ, the Lord of creation. In the last few months, I've begun to see Christ's ministry described in a new and exciting way, at least new to me. What is being suggested is that one of the ways that Christ can heal us is to come into our lives, model for us what it means to be genuinely and truly healthy-minded, and then enter into our existence and go all the way back and all the way down to the place where the great mistake was made and the wrong interpretation and name was given, and therefore the place where the poison began. Peter A. Jones the other morning said that Jesus was the liberated and therefore liberating person. I would say to us that he is the Savior because he models healthy-mindedness. And what did Jesus do? Contrary to Charlie Brown, from the very beginning, he affirmed the thing that God had given him in the act of creation. And instead of saying, not right for the part, he dared to say, because I come from the hand of the Father, I am right for the part, He accepted the gift of his own personhood as something positive, and beginning with that kind of good gift, he allowed himself to be reinforced. He took Genesis 1 seriously. If you'll go back and read how God feels about what he's created, he calls the world into being, and then after 6 days, the Hebrew says that he looked back over all that he has made, and the image here is very primitive. It's the picture of a child that has built some kind of sandcastle or something that brings him infinite delight, and he looks at it and he begins to rub his hands in relish, and the Hebrew has God saying, "It's good, it's good, it's good, it's good, it's good." Jesus let the light of Genesis 1 shine on the event of his beginning. He dared to feel about his own creation the way God feels about everything that he has created, and he allowed himself to be reinforced. When it came time for him to begin his ministry, he went down to the Jordan, identified himself, went under the waters, and when he came up, the heavens parted, and he heard this indescribable voice of affirmation saying, "This is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. This is my boy in whom I take delight. This is the apple of my eye." And Jesus took that positive affirmation of his own being. He made this the foundation stone of all his doing and all his activity. He grounded his life in the belief that what God had made him was something good. And that's what gave him the power to go through life in healthy-mindedness. One day he found himself teaching a whole horde of people. The sun began to go down. The crowd got restless. The disciples got uneasy, and they said, "You better send them away, Lord. They're going to get angry because they're hungry." And Jesus shocked the everything out of them by saying, "How much food do we have here to feed these people?" But these guys were so tuned in on the half-emptiness of that situation, it never occurred to them that there were resources in the situation to utilize. And they rustled around and found 5 loaves and 2 fish. And Jesus says, "Let's have it." He gave thanks for what he had been given, half full. And he began to separate it and begin to multiply it. And it was enough for everybody. Is there anyone there that on the last night of his life, he did what he had been doing every day of his life? The Gospels say he took the loaf and gave thanks, and then broke it and gave it to his disciples. That's healthy-mindedness. Taking what you have been given, celebrating it in gratitude, giving it away with abandon because you know there's more where that came from. Jesus modeled what it means to be healthy-minded. He let Genesis 1 shine on the event of his own creation. And this thing that I've been hearing about the ministry of Jesus lately, it is called the healing of the memories, is the incredible proposition that the risen Christ is no more bounded by time than he is by space, that he has the power to enter your life and go back with you to all of those painful experiences that have caused you to feel negative about yourself and about the world, that he can go back and help you unlearn and relearn and rename those experiences so instead of there being sending poison into your system, they are healed and become the reinforcements of the delight of God that has followed you like goodness and mercy all the days of your life. As I hear the ministry of Jesus described this way, I'm astonished at how it parallels the other kind of healing that has been so prominent in the 20th century. I'm thinking now about psychoanalysis or psychotherapy. If you go to an analyst, what they will do is to try to take you back to the traumatic experiences of your existence and help you unlearn, reinterpret, and put a positive construction. You can't change what has happened, but you can change the name that you give it. And lo and behold, I find that Christ is now being promised as one who can do for us what also psychotherapists have been doing, to go all the way back and all the way down and help you unlearn, relearn, re-image the old experiences that are the root of basic anxiety. I know what psychotherapy is all about. 6 weeks after my daughter died in January of 1970 of a long, tedious illness with leukemia, One Saturday at home, a psychiatrist called me. I knew him well, though he was not a member of my church. And he said to me that a member of the congregation who was his patient had said to him the day before, "I perceive that Dr. Claypool, in the midst of all of his grief, is deeply depressed." And the psychiatrist said, "You have every reason to be that after what you have been through. I would like to offer you my companionship. If you'd like to work with me through your depression, I will offer you this without charge." Well, my first reaction was sheer terror. Have you ever had a psychiatrist call you up on Saturday morning and tell you something about yourself that you thought you were keeping carefully hidden, and then to offer to do something about your problem? My first reaction was sheer terror. My second reaction was, hey, here is a gift of tremendous value that is being offered to you while it is being offered. Just like Jesus took the bread and gave thanks, you ought to do that. So for the next 18 months, every Tuesday morning at 8 o'clock, I went down to Kentucky Baptist Hospital, went into the psychiatric ward of that particular facility, and met with this psychiatrist. Let me be perfectly honest, the first few weeks, I would act like I was going in there to visit some other patients as a minister, and then I would stealthily slip in the door so that nobody would realize that I, big minister, was also receiving that kind of help. Why do we feel ashamed of our needfulness? If I had an appendicitis, would I be ashamed to let a surgeon help me? But if it's an emotional or a mental difficulty, we still have this old shame. But I went with that man, and he companioned me back and helped me unravel and relearn and rethink so many things that had been sending poison into my system. Therefore, when I hear it said that the risen Christ is not bounded any more by time than he is by space, that he can go all the way back to those painful experiences, even back to the event of our birth, and bring the light of Genesis 1 to bear on that darkness in which somehow we came to the conclusion that we were not right for the part when we sat on the stage. Do you hear what I'm saying? That Christ can heal us of this chronic dissatisfaction that goes all the way back and all the way down to the first thing that God ever did to us. Could this be part of what it means to be born again? That word has been given such prominence since President Carter has become what he is. Been so much a media debate, and I know it has many implications, but tonight I want to close by suggesting that one of the significances of that image just might be that if we would allow the risen Christ to take us all the way back to the event of our birth, and there enable us to re-image and rename the significance of that event, that could be the beginning of a healing, that if we could ever get to feeling good about the first thing God ever did to us in creation, then we could move to the right side of the spectrum, and by the grace of Christ, having been healed, we could say, "I'm okay, you're okay, we're okay, they're okay, it's okay." Not perfect. Much yet to be done, but the kinds of creatures in whom God takes delight and esteems, for whom God sees a future and all kinds of prospects, I'm suggesting that what it may mean to be born again is to allow the risen Christ to take you all the way back to the first thing that ever happened to you, and let the light of Genesis 1 break in on the darkness that you have allowed to enshroud that event. What if you let the delight that God has over the event of your creation become the foundation stone of all your dealing with the rest of creation? I'm suggesting that could become an event of healing that can make all the difference in the world for the living of your days. I saw that happen just 3 weeks ago. Was down at Laity Lodge in Texas working with some of these same ideas. And I noticed that a nice-looking young woman began to listen intently when I talked about the negative feelings that so often attach themselves to our beginnings. It seemed to me at times that I saw tears beginning to course down her face. And on the last afternoon, she asked if she could speak with me privately. And she said, "I simply had to tell you of something that has transpired this week." She said, all my life, I, like Charlie Brown, have felt I wasn't right for the part. She said, I was the third of four daughters. It was made very clear to me as soon as I became aware that my parents had wanted me to be a boy. One of the ways that that is communicated is that my two older sisters have baby books that are just bulging with pictures. My baby book has simply my name, not even my date written in it, and not one single picture. And my father used to look at me and shake his head and say, oh, I wish you had been a boy. She said, all my life, I've had the feeling that I didn't come on the stage right. I was not what they wanted. If I'd only been something different, then I would have been something better. And she said, this week, as I heard you talk about the darkness that goes all the way back and all the way down, I realized the pain that I have been bearing every day of my existence. She said, this afternoon, I did what she said do. I asked the risen Christ, who is not bounded anymore by time and by space, to go with me back through the pathway of pain. And she said, he took me all the way back and all the way down, and he gave me a new sense of the positive meaning of my own birth. And she said, do you know what I've done? I've written for myself a birth announcement. I'm going to go home and I'm going to paste it in that empty baby book that sits there as a reminder to me that I was not what my parents wanted. And then she handed me this piece of paper on which was written in clearly legible hand, this day I did something absolutely extraordinary. I created Catherine Elliott. She is my beloved daughter, in whom I am well pleased, my girl in whom I take delight. She is very, very good. Signed, God. Jesus gave her a new image of her own birth. Therefore, tonight we are not going to have a formal public open invitation. But let me ask you to make this final use of our time together. I've asked my good friend and colleague, Ken Miedema, who's been in on what it is that I've tried to say tonight. I have invited him to respond to what I have said and to lead you in a closing corporate act. But as he does it, here's what I invite you to do. I invite you to examine to what degree you have lived out your life in chronic dissatisfaction, because the first thing God ever did to you did not seem to you to be good. I invite you to let the risen Christ, miracle of miracles, enter and go as far back as he needs to go, even if he has to go back to the very beginning, and let the light of Genesis 1 begin to shine. I invite you to hold up your whole existence and allow the one who participated in your creation, who was at the Father's side when he saw that relish of delight, the created delight that God feels for everything that he's made, I invite you to let the risen Christ enable you to be born again.